Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures. For more than 50 years, the museum has told stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character. Details at texancultures.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies.
In a deep and dark December, I am alone, gazing from my window to the streets below, on a freshly fallen silent shroud of snow. I am a rock.
This is Simon and Garfunkel singing about the destructive power of loneliness. Today we know that it's more than just feeling blue and being socially isolated. It is also a health problem. Today we're talking about the neuroscience of friendship and loneliness. With us today, Dr. Michael Platt. He's a neuroscientist at the University of Pennsylvania, and he is a guest speaker at the Mind Science Foundation event this evening. The neuroscience of friendship takes place tonight at 6:30 at Pearl Stable. And also with us online, Julianne Holt-Lundstad, professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University. Welcome both y'all to The Source. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here.
So this song, I Am a Rock, I Am an Island, you know, it's a celebration of what we have, of being alone, of I am a rock. And this kind of was an attitude that was almost embraced, but now we're knowing that it is destructive. I mean, what do you hear in that song, Dr. Platt?
Well, I'd really love to hear what Julianne has to say, because she's an incredible expert in this area and has done some of the most profound and important work documenting the impact of loneliness on health and longevity. To me, you're right. It's. I think there's something quite important here, and we have thought that kind of the idea of being alone, there's nothing wrong with that. If that's what you want, right? And there are times when we need to be alone to be productive, to gather our thoughts. But in general, we are a social species. We are highly specialized to work together, and we're highly motivated to be connected with others. And human beings, like other highly social species, we really depend on those connections. And when we don't have them, it can be really difficult for us to function properly.
And Julianne Holt-Lundstad, what do you think?
Yeah, so I think that song also highlights that in some ways there's somewhat of this tension between almost our cultural norms around the ideal of being independent. And then as was just mentioned, the fact that we are social beings, and that it really is, you know, throughout human history been adaptive for us to be a part of a group, to be with others, and that while there may be times where being alone can be helpful, that when experienced more on a chronic basis, that this can ultimately lead to more detrimental effects.
Our phone number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You could also email us with your questions and comments at thesource@tpr.org, tweet at us at tprsource. As we talk about the destructive power of loneliness and what a healthful impact friendship can be for you, call in and talk about how you've experienced this and maybe ways that you've cracked the code and you've found ways to make friendships, lasting friendships, powerful friendships in adulthood, which seems to be something that a lot of people are struggling with these days. Dr. Michael Platt, tell me more about your research. What do you mean by the neuroscience of friendship?
Sure, I'm happy to talk about that. I mean, over the last, 15 or 20 years, my group has really focused on trying to uncover the biology that allows us to make connections with people and to manage those connections. And so really an amazing discovery in neuroscience over the last decade and a half is that each of us has within our brains a circuit, a network of brain areas that is more or less dedicated to managing our connections with others. So we often refer to this as the social brain network. And it's a series of brain areas that is important for perceiving the people around us, identifying them, understanding and reading their emotional states, and then that information basically flows into a few different parts of the social brain network that allow us to, on the one hand, kind of empathize or resonate with another individual's experience, which is important for motivating, helping behavior, cooperation, et cetera. And then kind of another component of this network that is a little bit more cognitive and that is really tasked with trying to form a mental model of those other individuals so that we can predict their behavior. And so together, that that information kind of comes together to determine whether we help somebody, whether we cooperate, whether we cheat. And then basically we learn from that and that whole process kind of runs again. So that's kind of the foundation, the founding circuit that we work on. And we try to understand both its basic function as well as what might be broken in that network biologically in people who have trouble connecting with others. And by that, I mean individuals who suffer from disorders with social impairments like autism or social anxiety or schizophrenia, in which there's something that is not working quite right because those individuals have difficulty making connections.
Or even PTSD.
Absolutely. So, honestly, because social behavior is so important for us. The most devastating and ultimately complex of human disorders have a social component, no matter what.
And Julianne Holt Lundstedt, some people have said this is a Darwinistic development, that this is something when people are good at this, they survive better. And so now maybe we're not in the Serengeti in tribes anymore, but we're now in cities and driven into maybe some sort of self-confined isolation, but we still have this call of the wild.
Yeah. So one of the things that my lab has been looking at is to see whether or not this is, to what extent does this have an effect? And so we gathered all of the available evidence on this that was available worldwide and was able to look at the data in terms of how it predicts risk for mortality. And one factor that we looked at to see was whether this was affected, by country or by time. This is just as true today as the earliest studies. And so, indeed, this is something that still is a profound effect even in our modern lifestyle.
We're talking about the neuroscience of friendship and loneliness. We invite you to call in. The number is 210-614-8980. Tell us about have you ever really, really felt lonely, and did you feel it taking an impact on your health? Call in 210-614-8980. This is Mr. Lonely.
Lonely, I'm Mr. Lonely. I have nobody for my own. I'm so lonely, I'm Mr. Lonely.
That's San Antonio's own Royal Jesters singing about being a lonely guy. We're talking about the neuroscience of friendship and loneliness today on The Source. You can call in with your own experiences of loneliness, feeling socially isolated, having friendships, how friendships have really enriched your life. And now we're seeing a lot more science about how it makes you more healthy. It makes medicine work better. It actually adds years to your life. What should we be doing as a community to create more opportunities to find lasting friendships and to help people who are dealing with loneliness and isolation? You can call in. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Let's go to William on the phones. And William, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey, I heard briefly just on the programs, you know, a couple of you guys speaking up on using data points to kind of predict mental models of people and just using that as a way to kind of determine what kind of behavioral patterns that people you're interacting with are going to be falling into and how to kind of treat those relationships.
All right, William, thank you for that. Dr. Michael Platt is with us. He's a neuroscientist at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's a guest speaker at the Mind Science Foundation event this evening, the Neuroscience of Friendship. That's at 6:30 at Pearl Stable. And so what does your research tell us about plotting out these types of things?
Yeah, well, I think what the caller might have been asking a question about is whether we can kind of use the tools of big data and AI and machine learning and other kinds of data-driven approaches to develop a more quantitative, precise understanding of people. And I think there's clearly a huge drive going on in the tech world to do that, perhaps with different ends in mind. But, you know, that's one thing that we have been trying to do as well at the Wharton Neuroscience Initiative, which I lead, which is trying to take a lot of this science and put it into the service of making business more efficient, more effective, and more humane. And so one of the ways in which we can utilize that kind of information as well as more biological information is to give us a deeper understanding of who people are and how people, particular individuals, actually work better together or worse together. So can we use that kind of data to drive the kind of selection and placing of people on, say, workplace teams, whether that's in sports or in a company, so that they work better together, their performance is higher, and they're actually happier, which would reduce turnover. So that would kind of be a win-win for everybody.
So my second grade report card has that thing about does not play well with others.
That's right.
So it's more important than we probably gave it credit for. Julianne Holt-Lenstad, professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University, you're looking at this really at how this is a risk factor for mortality, loneliness being. How significant is that for folks?
How significant is
loneliness
for mortality?
Yeah.
So what we find is that it significantly predicts risk for premature mortality. And keep in mind that this data comes from data available worldwide. And in fact, we had data from over 3.4 million participants. And keep in mind, we also looked at both social isolation and loneliness, and both of them predicted risk for premature mortality, and equivalently so. And so while loneliness is really more of that subjective experience of feeling alone, or that discrepancy between one's actual and desired level of connection, the presence of or absence of others, which would be more objective isolation, seems to be just as important. And to put it into perspective, the effect that it has on risk for premature mortality was comparable to other kinds of factors that we take very seriously for our health. So, for instance, it exceeded the risk associated with obesity, physical inactivity, and air pollution, just to name a few.
And do are we able to really quantify what are we talking about when we say loneliness, Dr. Michael Platt? I mean, what is that?
So, well, I think clinically speaking, Julianne was quite clear on that, which is loneliness is really that subjective feeling that you are alone and that you don't want to be alone and that there's something missing from your life. Whereas, you know, whether you're isolated or not is something that is much more objectively measurable. for us, I mean, and I'd like to kind of emphasize and build upon some of the points that Julianne was making. This, you know, I spend about half my life studying monkeys as a comparison for humans. And that is, I think, really important because it reveals a lot about how deep this biology goes. So we study the behavior and biology of rhesus macaques, with which humans shared a common ancestor about 25 to 30 million years ago. And they are just as specialized for social interactions as we are. They form friendships and alliances, and we can objectively map out the social networks of these animals. So it's more like measuring that kind of social isolation that Julianne was talking about. And, you know, we and others have demonstrated that, you know, a monkey who has lots of friends lives longer and has more babies and seems to be a healthier animal, whereas a monkey who has only one or a couple of connections doesn't do so well. And then there are monkeys who are isolated for whatever reason, and those monkeys actually tend to do quite poorly. So they share that same kind of biology for social connection that we do, and it's critically important for their lives and for their success.
And what can we learn from that in the terms of trying to adapt that to the benefits that the popular monkeys do really well?
Yeah, they do. You know, that can be a little bit dispiriting because one of the things we've also discovered is that this is at least partially genetic. So a monkey who's a popular monkey who's in the mix and has lots of friends, generally their offspring will be the same, even if they move to another group. And monkeys who are more isolated, their offspring will tend to be more isolated. And we've uncovered some of the genes that seem to play a role in that behavior. So that can be worrisome. But on the other hand, there is reason for optimism because we know, especially from, you know, really great work by colleagues at Oxford, who mapped out the social brain network in monkeys who were basically living alone using brain scans. And then they put these monkeys experimentally into different size groups. So some monkeys had to learn how to get along with one other monkey. Some monkeys had to figure out how to get along with 5 or 10 or 30 other monkeys. And basically, this social brain network is a bit like a muscle. So the more that you work it, the more that you exercise it, the more that you grow. And what they found is that literally the thickness of the cortex in these brain areas, which reflects connections between neurons, got bigger in those monkeys who were put into bigger groups, right, and had to figure out how to get along with them. And maybe there were some other protective effects there as well that allowed their brains to flourish. So, yeah, we can learn a lot, and there's even more that's on the way.
From Marcy on Twitter, today there are so many ways to connect, but we seem more lonely than ever. Julianne Holt-Lundstad, have you observed that?
Yeah, so that is, I think, a big question because we hear lots of people or the media headlines of a loneliness epidemic, which suggests that it's something that is increasing or rising. And so one of the things that's hard to really determine is the extent to which it is increasing because loneliness hasn't been systematically assessed in the population. And so we do have some large-scale population-based studies that have assessed this in previous years. However, there's discrepancies in terms of how it's being measured. So, for example, there were three different national surveys that came out in 2018 that all reported slightly different prevalence rates, ranging from 22% to nearly half of the adult population being classified as lonely. And so it's difficult to say for certain that loneliness specifically has increased. But what we can say is even at the most conservative estimate of 22%, that's still a significant portion of the population that is affected. And so, of course, we need to take that seriously. But, of course, there's also other kinds of demographic kinds of trends that might suggest that we are becoming a bit more socially disconnected. That includes things like more people living alone, fewer people engaging in religious participation or volunteering. There's some evidence to suggest that social network sizes are decreasing and that fewer people are participating in social groups. And so these other kinds of data points suggest that may be the case. But of course, these are just indicators of potential social disconnection and doesn't necessarily mean that someone's lonely. So, for instance, you can live alone and still have a wide social network and not feel lonely. However, there is data to suggest that living alone increases your risk of being lonely. So that's where we can look to some of these as potential risk factors that suggest that there may be some decrease in terms of our level of social connection.
So a study published this month in the journal Psychology and Aging found that loneliness has less to do with the number of friends that you have and more to do with how you feel about your friends. So Julianne, is that also something you've seen?
So it really has to do with how these things are measured. And so, you know, like I said, if you're socially isolated, so if you have few people in your social network, that can increase your risk of loneliness, but they're not the same thing. And so you can be you can have a wide social network and still feel profoundly lonely. And conversely, you can be socially isolated and not feel lonely. You might enjoy being alone and enjoy that solitude. And so it is important to recognize that while these can go hand in hand, they are distinct. And but nonetheless, having a small social network does increase the risk for being lonely.
And Dr. Michael Platt, the being lonely, how does that affect the brain? Do we see like pain receptors, you know, more sensitive, or is it having to do with dopamine release? I mean, are there chemical things flying around or shouldn't be flying around? What's going on up in there?
Well, I think this is not very well understood right now. So we do know that people who have sort of deeper or more extensive social network, that it seems to be writ into the structure of their brains, in the sense that the connections within and between these areas of the social brain network seem to be bigger, more dense, whatever.
So why does it make higher functioning? Why does it make you sad?
that's a really great question. Presumably, that is a mechanism, a motivational signal to get you out and to interact with others. Although clearly, it doesn't always work that way.
So it's your brain giving you some sort of driving force, like hunger. Go out and meet people and do something with
that's
them.
That's right.
All right, so this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about neuroscience of friendship and loneliness. Call in. The number is 210-614-8980. We'll be right back.
Hear that lonesome whippoorwill. He sounds too blue to fly. The midnight train is whining low. I'm so lonesome I could cry.
Immigration.
I think we need to all get in before the wall goes up.
Health.
The Promotora, they have all the resources that can get them the help that they need.
Art.
There's this kind of subversiveness to it, right?
We cover all these topics and more on Fronteras as we examine issues along the border and beyond. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras where you find your favorite podcasts.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Are you like Eleanor Rigby? Do you feel like you're the one part of all those lonely people? And where do you belong? Where can you find some interaction? We know that being lonely, having a lack of meaningful relationships, friendships in your life, actually is causing some wear and tear on your brain and on your body. And it would do you good to get out and meet new people. We'll talk more about the neuroscience of that with Dr. Michael Platt. He's a neuroscientist at the University of Pennsylvania. He's speaking tonight at the Mind Science Foundation. They have an event, the Neuroscience of Friendship. It's tonight at 6:30 at the Pearl Stable. Julianne Holt-Lundstedt is with us, professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University. Our phone number is 210-614-8980. We'd love for you to call in and tell us what you think about this. 210-614-8980. Let's go to Daryl Greer. He's with us. He is program lead for Older Adults Technology Services, OATS, in San Antonio. And Daryl, welcome to The Source.
Hi, thank you.
So tell us about OATS.
So we are Older Adult Technology Services. We're a nonprofit that's here in San Antonio. And what we do is we train older adults on how to build a foundation of understanding when it comes to technology.
And how does that plug into creating, trying to deal with the loneliness issues?
Well, as, of course, our population has found new ways to connect with one another utilizing technology, there's a segment of the population that has not received the same kind of training or understanding regarding the technology and the benefits of items like social media, being able to use the internet to find like-minded individuals for people to connect and socialize with. So our goal is to help train and build a new community of seniors that are able to connect online.
And are these seniors that make use of your services at OATS, do they tell you that they are finding meaningful relationships through technology?
Yes, we do. We do screen, and we do have our classes that are in areas that are at risk of having older adults that are isolated. But in the beginning of our classes, which are 5 weeks or 10 weeks long, we do pre and post assessments on all of our students. So then that we're able to gauge the impact of our classes during their classroom journey. At the end of it, it's approximately 12 hours of instruction that those participants receive.
All right, Dale Greer, thank you for telling us about the OATS and how you're helping San Antonio's older adults find connections online. Dr. Michael Platt, neuroscientist at the University of Pennsylvania, can you tell me, like, what happens to the brain when you look at the human face? Does anything particular happen? Is the human face an important part of interactions?
The human face is critical, and we are driven to look at human faces. And if you actually track the eyes of a person while they scan, and you know they look at any kind of a painting or an image or a scene, they're drawn to look at the faces. And when we look at a face, there are particular features of the face that attract our attention immediately. And so there's a characteristic pattern of looking at the eyes and the mouth and kind of a triangle. If we look in the brain, there is a part of the brain, well, there are many areas of the brain that respond when we see faces, but they respond for different reasons. But there's one particular brain area that has been hypothesized to actually be highly specialized and dedicated for processing faces, basically for identifying a face as a human face, and then kind of deconstructing everything about it. So who it is, what they're, you know, old, young, male, female, state of mind, familiar, unfamiliar, et cetera. And that is critically informative for guiding our behavior.
And it's interesting that when we have emojis, you know, those are like very simplified human faces that we use to try to add context to messages online where you're not seeing a human face.
Yeah, I think it's an attempt to obviously it's an attempt to add some more nuance and some more social color, if you will, to an otherwise very impoverished medium for communication. So, you know, our brains evolved for face-to-face communication and interaction. And so our brains are exquisitely specialized for extracting all this information that we're not even aware of, the micro expressions, the movements of all these muscles in your face, tone of voice, body posture, you name it. And that helps us to understand the other individual that we are interacting with. Now, put that into a text, right? You know, it's so stripped down, and we've all had the experience of miscommunication or, you know, taking the wrong tone from that, and kind of that can be really problematic. So that's where emojis come in. They're helpful. They're certainly cute.
But
they don't always work.
There's no substitute. Real quick, though, is the part of the brain that looks for faces and reads faces, is that connected to the part of the brain where language is processed? How far are they part of it?
You know, they are the kind of first stage, if you will, of face processing, of perception, occurs in the kind of the temporal lobe. Kind of the first stages of language understanding, decoding the stream of communication that you hear is in the temporal lobe too, but they're basically quite separate, and kind of connecting a face to what it's saying seems to happen much farther on.
All right, let's go to the callers. Number is 210-614-8980 with Deborah. Deborah, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me. I have a quick question regarding solitary confinement. I have a relative in prison, and I know that's been highlighted in media. Can this report, this study, correlate with that at all?
Deborah, thank you for calling in. That's a great question. Julianne Holt-Lundstad, professor of psychology, neuroscience at Brigham Young University. What are the health impacts of people who are kept in solitary confinement? I mean, that is part that you don't want to conduct scientific experiments on individuals, human beings, but we're kind of doing that in this in an inhumane sort of way.
Right. So that becomes a really tricky point because, of course, as researchers, it would be unethical for us to randomly assign some participants to be put in solitary confinement, be completely socially isolated, and others you know, allowed to be social. And so I think this actually, because of this, has led to some question around the causal nature of the overall evidence. So while researchers who work on humans certainly can't do that, researchers who work with animals are able to house animals individually versus socially, and of course find experimentally that housing animals in individually or in isolation leads to a whole host of negative outcomes. And so, you know, bringing it back to in terms of whether or not we can draw causal conclusions around this. Importantly, we are able to look, not only draw on that animal literature, but we also have evidence of the direction of that effect. So we've followed people over time, so we know that it's being isolated or lonely that predicts earlier death rather than people who are just in poorer health are subsequently more isolated or lonely, and really it's the poorer health. We've been able to rule that out regardless of one's initial health status. Those who are more socially isolated or lonely are at greater risk for mortality. And we're able to draw upon additional kinds of evidence so that we are able to it meets the same kinds of causal criteria as the criteria that was used to establish smoking as a causal factor for earlier mortality. And so the same criteria has been met in this case. So, yes, unfortunately, the evidence does point to a causal effect on heightened risk for premature mortality.
So studying isolation of people and loneliness and how that impacts people's health, some people have built a case that putting people in prison in isolation for long terms, like people have been in isolation for years, that's cruel and unusual punishment. And I don't know, Julianne, would your research sort of sound like it would support that?
The research definitely supports the detrimental health effects, and of course, there's other research that shows mental health effects as well.
Yeah, I've certainly seen people in prison who have been in isolation for a long time, and they tell me that it almost breaks them. And when we come back from the break, we'll talk more about the neuroscience of friendship and loneliness. I certainly want to get some callers on the air. What's the importance of human skin contact? You know, it's not just seeing other individuals, but also being able to interact with them and feeling them in a warm and compassionate way. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You call in 210-614-8980. We'll be right back.
Are you lonesome tonight? Do you miss me tonight? Are you sorry we drifted apart? Does your memory stray to a bright summer day?
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about neuroscience of friendship and loneliness. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. Tell us how you are dealing with, maybe you have loneliness in your life. You feel isolated. You want to interact with other people, yet you find it challenging. Are you found that society has made this harder than it has to be, and we should be talking about this openly? We should be figuring this out. This is a problem that we can solve because it does have a consequence. It is costing people years of life. It's making folks miserable. Why are we doing this to ourselves? Call in. The number is 210-614-8980. Let's get Maureen on the air. And Maureen, thanks for calling in, and you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, David. Thank you for taking my call. I wonder if in a case of forced exile, during a divorce, I was exiled. Don't ask me. 2 years, the judge said to me, you have to leave Bexar County. And my ex-husband worked for 2 years to just torment me, whatever. And I had a portrait studio. I was so social. I was all over the city, best time of my life. And then he left, and through this divorce, standing right in the district court here, this judge said, you have 30 days to leave Bexar County, and you can't come back for 2 years with all these fears of
so right. So without litigating your divorce, Maureen, you know, so you were very lonely. You were driven. You were banished, basically, from, you know, your community. Banishment, that's kind of like a very old school way of people treating people in our original tribal system, I guess. Dr. Michael Platt, neuroscientist at the University of Pennsylvania, as you have studied the chimps and the macaques and the monkeys, is that something that they do as punishment for, as a sanction, banishment or isolating people?
Yeah, it doesn't quite work that way. And I'm certainly sensitive to the caller's plight. I mean, that sounds quite awful. But rather what you see in non-human primates is that you know, some individuals, for whatever reason, they will get, they'll run afoul of, you know, there's a strict dominance hierarchy in most primate species, you know, sort of similar to human society.
They have rules.
As well, they have rules. And, you know, if you run afoul of the hierarchy, if you, if you're a male, for example, who's kind of riding high, lots of connections, alpha male, and then you are kind of deposed, you're often, you can be driven from the group. We also see that for in macaques, males typically leave the group that they're born into when they reach sexual maturity, and they kind of wander around, you know, in the desert, as it will, looking for a group in which to immigrate into. And that's sort of a difficult time for these animals, and they don't always find a group into which they can belong. So it's not so much that it's a group-sanctioned, really, activity, but it's sort of a part of the process, if you will. And it's a difficult part of the process. And we know that when those animals are not part of the group, that they're more likely to be predated on, for example, and die an early death.
Got an email from Michael. It says, I have been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome. My inability to read social cues makes being part of a group close to impossible, and I wind up finding peace of mind in solo endeavors. Do you know of research regarding loneliness as it pertains to people who are not neurotypical or neuroatypical? Julianne Holt-Lundstad, professor of psychology, neuroscience at Brigham Young University. How does people who are Asperger's syndrome, who have that, have been diagnosed, how does that enter into this?
Yeah, so first of all, I should mention that my work specifically does not focus on that. However, there are others that I collaborate with and that are certainly active researchers in this field who have looked at how various psychological conditions can potentially put people at greater risk. And so whether it be Asperger's or social anxiety, or some of the conditions that Dr. Platt was referring to earlier, that this can be associated with an increased risk for loneliness and social isolation. And so we need to certainly be very mindful of that. And I think also to the point of the previous caller, Maureen, when she talked about her situation, is that whether it be a psychological condition or more external situations, such as life transitions or having to leave your social network, you know, for other kinds of reasons, like a job transfer or retirement, that there are points that can identify people who may be potentially at increased risk, and that by potentially identifying those who may be at increased risk early on, that we can identify ways in which we can address the issue earlier on rather than waiting till a problem becomes quite severe, which is much more difficult to deal with.
Right. And an intervention or instruction, some sort of coaching, counseling, navigation help for people, could that make a difference, Julianne?
So researchers are looking into that. And the one thing that I think is probably frustrating for a lot of people is that we have very robust evidence in terms of the health effects of this, the both physical and mental health. We're really learning a lot about the pathways and understanding that. But where we are, we have a major challenge right now is really identifying effective ways to mitigate risk. And unfortunately, there is mixed evidence out there. And so we don't have a silver bullet, you know, go do this and you'll be fine. And part of that is because there may be multiple underlying causes of both social isolation and loneliness. And so a one-size-fits-all approach is unlikely to be successful for everyone. Certainly researchers are working very hard to try and identify the kinds of approaches that may be more successful for whom and in what kinds of situations.
All right. So there's a lot to be, you know, processed with that. I know one size is not going to fit all. People have gone through all sorts of different challenges. But for people who have dealt with trauma, PTSD, it seems like they are dealing with some sort of self-isolation as part of their own symptoms. And Dr. Michael Platt, should we be looking at trying to reach out to people as a society? Should we? This is obviously a human health problem, a public health problem. What are we doing to deal with it?
Well, you're right. This is a huge problem. It seems to potentially be growing, at least in terms of our awareness, especially with veterans returning from service and who have seen combat.
Or anyone who is a victim of violence?
Violence, just in general. Any kind of adverse life event could have a really negative impact that could lead toward all kinds of mental health and psychological health problems. One of the challenges is that we know that having social support is protective under those conditions. So if you have a tighter knit group of friends or relatives that can provide support, that can be a benefit to you. But we don't really understand how that works. And part of the problem is that it's hard to address the biological mechanisms in people, as we've talked about, and sort of standard animal models, like looking at mice in the laboratory, doesn't really help because mice don't form the kinds of connections that we do, and a lot of their biology isn't shared. So actually, we have begun quite an ambitious project which tries to leverage a singular cataclysmic event so it was Hurricane Maria that hit Puerto Rico a couple of years ago. And obviously devastated the island, and there were lots of deaths, lots of people developing behavioral and mental health issues. We happen to have been studying a population of monkeys on an island off the coast of Puerto Rico for 12 years. And so we have lots of biological data, genetic data, and behavioral data on those animals prior to the hurricane and then subsequent to the hurricane. And so this is allowing us to track and unpack what's going on under the hood in terms of the biological and social and behavioral factors that might be protective. And one of the things that's so remarkable already in the data that we have is that what we've seen there, which is pretty much what you hear reported in people after a hurricane or after a tornado, people band together. They're selfless. They work together. But that kind of fades away. But in these monkeys, they become tighter knit. They're more egalitarian. They're more equal in their distribution of social capital, if you will, and that's continuing in the 2 years since that tragic event.
Dr. Michael Platt, neuroscientist at the University of Pennsylvania. He is speaking tonight on the neuroscience of friendship at the Pearl Stable with the Mind Science Foundation, the neuroscience of friendship. Also with us, Julianne Holt-Lundstad, professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia, and Jan Ross Piedad. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.
How to be sure. Sometimes I feel so weird.